Chapter 19. To the relief of his capital, bursting through ranks upon ranks of the enemy, and crushing or scattering them from the path of his swift and victorious despair, the emperor at last is at home. Where are the great dignitaries and the lieutenant generals of the empire? Where is Maria Luisa, the Empress Eagle, with her little callow king of Rome? Is she going to defend her nest and her eaglet? Not she. Empress Queen, Lieutenant General, and court dignitaries are off on the wings of all the winds profligati sunt. They are away with the money bags, and Louis Stanislaus Xavier rolls into the palace of his fathers. With regard to Napoleon's excellences as an administrator, a legislator, a constructor of public works, and a skillful financier, his nephew speaks with much diffuse praise, and few persons, we suppose, will be disposed to contradict him. Whether the emperor composed his famous code, or borrowed it, is of little importance. But he established it, and made the law equal for every man in France except one. His vast public works and vaster wars were carried on without new loans or exorbitant taxes. It was only the blood and liberty of the people that were taxed, and we shall want a better advocate than Prince Louis to show us that these were not most unnecessarily and lavishly thrown away. As for the former and material improvements, it is not necessary to confess here that a despotic energy can affect such far more readily than a government, of which the strength is diffused in many conflicting parties. No doubt, if we could create a despotical governing machine, a steam autocrat, passionless, untiring, and supreme, we should advance further and live more at ease than under any other form of government. Ministers might enjoy their pensions and follow their own devices. Lord John might compose histories or tragedies at his leisure, and Lord Palmerston, instead of racking his brains to write leading articles for Cupid, might crown his locks with flowers and sing, Greek text omitted, his natural anacreontics. But alas, not so. If the despotic government has its good side, Prince Louis Napoleon must acknowledge that it has its bad, and it is for this that the civilized world is compelled to substitute for it something more orderly and less capricious. Good as the imperial government might have been, it must be recollected too that since its first fall, both the emperor and his admirer and would-be successor have had their chance of re-establishing it. Fly from steeple to steeple the eagles of the former did actually, and according to promise perch for a while on the towers of Notre Dame. We know the event. If the fate of war declared against the emperor, the country declared against him too. And, with old Lafayette for a mouthpiece, the representatives of the nation did, in a neat speech, pronounce themselves in permanence, but spoke no more of the emperor than if he had never been. Thereupon the emperor proclaimed his son the Emperor Napoleon II. L'Empereur est mort, vive l'Empereur! Shouted Prince Lucien. Not a soul echoed the words. The play was played, and as for old Lafayette and his eminent representatives, a corporal with a hammer nailed up the door of their spouting club, and once more Louis Stanislaus Xavier rolled back to the bosom of his people. In like manner Napoleon III returned from exile, and made his appearance on the frontier. His eagle appeared at Strasbourg, and from Strasbourg advanced to the capital, but it arrived at Paris with a keeper, and in a post-chaise, whence, by the orders of the sovereign, it was removed to the American shores, and there magnanimously let loose. Who knows, however, how soon it may be on the wing again, and what a flight it will take. The story of Mary Ansell. Go, my nephew, said old Father Jacob to me, and complete thy studies at Strasbourg. Heaven surely hath ordained thee for the ministry in these times of trouble, and my excellent friend Schneider will work out the divine intention. Schneider was an old college friend of Uncle Jacob's, was a Benedictine monk, and a man famous for his learning. As for me, I was at that time my uncle's chorister, clerk, and sacristan. I swept the church, chanted the prayers with my shrill treble, and swung the great copper incense pot on Sundays and feasts, and I toiled over the fathers for the other days of the week. The old gentleman said that my progress was prodigious, and, without vanity, I believe he was right, for I then verily considered that praying was my vocation, and not fighting, as I have found since. You would hardly conceive, said the captain, swearing a great oath, how devout, and how learned I was in those days. I talked Latin faster than my own beautiful patois of Alsatian French. I could utterly overthrow in argument every Protestant, heretics we called them, parson in the neighborhood, and there was a confounded sprinkling of these unbelievers in our part of the country. I prayed half a dozen times a day, I fasted thrice in a week, and, as for penance, I used to scourge my little sides, till they had no more feeling than a peg top. Such was the godly life I led at my Uncle Jacob's in the village of Steinbach. Our family had long dwelt in this place, and a large farm and a pleasant house were then in the possession of another uncle, Uncle Edward. He was the youngest of the three sons of my grandfather, but Jacob, the elder, had shown a decided vocation for the church, from, I believe, the age of three, and now was by no means tired of it at 60. My father, who was to have inherited the paternal property, was, as I hear, a terrible scamp and scapegrace, quarreled with his family, and disappeared altogether, living and dying at Paris. So far we knew through my mother, who came, poor woman, with me, a child of 6 months, on her bosom, was refused all shelter by my grandfather, but was housed and kindly cared for by my good Uncle Jacob. Here she lived for about 7 years, and the old gentleman, when she died, wept over her grave a great deal more than I did, who was then too young to mind anything but toys or sweetmeats. During this time my grandfather was likewise carried off. He left, as I said, the property to his son Edward, with a small proviso in his will that something should be done for me, his grandson. Edward was himself a widower, with one daughter, Mary, about 3 years older than I, and certainly she was the dearest little treasure with which Providence ever blessed a miserly father. By the time she was 15, 5 farmers, 3 lawyers, 12 Protestant parsons, and a lieutenant of dragoons had made her offers. It must not be denied that she was an heiress as well as a beauty, which, perhaps, had something to do with the love of these gentlemen. However, Mary declared that she intended to live single, turned away her lovers one after another, and devoted herself to the care of her father. Uncle Jacob was as fond of her as he was of any saint or martyr. As for me, at the mature age of 12 I had made a kind of divinity of her, and when we sang Ave Maria on Sundays I could not refrain from turning to her, where she knelt, blushing and praying and looking like an angel, as she was. Besides her beauty, Mary had a thousand good qualities. She could play better on the harpsichord, she could dance more lightly, she could make better pickles and puddings than any girl in Alsace. There was not a want or a fancy of the old hunks her father, or a wish of mine or my uncle's, that she would not gratify if she could. As for herself, the sweet soul had neither wants, nor wishes except to see us happy. I could talk to you for a year of all the pretty kindnesses that she would do for me. How, when she found me of early mornings among my books, her presence all cast a light upon the day. How she used to smooth and fold my little surplice, and embroider me caps and gowns for high feast days. How she used to bring flowers for the altar, and who could deck it so well as she? But sentiment does not come glibly from under a grizzled mustache, so I will drop it, if you please. Amongst other favors she showed me, Mary used to be particularly fond of kissing me. It was a thing I did, not so much value in those days, but I found that the more I grew alive to the extent of the benefit, the less she would condescend to confer it on me, till at last, when I was about 14, she discontinued it altogether, of her own wish at least. Only sometimes I used to be rude, and take what as he had now become so mighty unwilling to give. I was engaged in a contest of this sort one day with Mary, when, Just as I was about to carry off a kiss from her cheek, I was saluted with a staggering slap on my own, which was bestowed by Uncle Edward, and sent me reeling some yards down the garden. The old gentleman, whose tongue was generally as close as his purse, now poured forth a flood of eloquence which quite astonished me. I did not think that so much was to be said on any subject as he managed to utter on one, and that was abuse of me. He stamped, he swore, he screamed, and then, from complimenting me, he turned to Mary, and saluted her in a manner equally forcible and significant. She, who was very much frightened at the commencement of the scene, grew very angry at the coarse words he used, and the wicked motives he imputed to her. "The child is but 14," she said. "He is your own nephew, and a candidate for holy orders. Father, it is a shame that you should thus speak of me, your daughter, or of one of his holy profession." I did not particularly admire this speech myself, but it had an effect on my uncle, and was the cause of the words with which this history commences. The old gentleman persuaded his brother that I must be sent to Strasbourg, and there kept until my studies for the church were concluded. I was furnished with a letter to my uncle's old college chum, Professor Schneider, who was to instruct me in theology and Greek. I was not sorry to see Strasbourg, of the wonders of which I had heard so much, but felt very loth as the time drew near when I must quit my pretty cousin and my good old uncle. Mary and I managed, however, a parting walk, in which a number of tender things were said on both sides. I am told that you Englishmen consider it cowardly to cry. As for me, I wept and roared incessantly. When Mary squeezed me, for the last time, the tears came out of me, as if I had been neither more nor less than a great wet sponge. My cousin's eyes were stoically dry. Her ladyship had a part to play, and it would have been wrong for her to be in love with a young chit of 14, so she carried herself with perfect coolness, as if there was nothing the matter. I should not have known that she cared for me, had it not been for a letter which she wrote me a month afterwards. Then, nobody was by, and the consequence was that the letter was half washed away with her weeping. If as he had used the watering pot, the thing could not have been better done. Well, I arrived at Strasbourg, a dismal, old-fashioned, rickety town in those days, and straightway presented myself and letter at Schneider's door. Over it was written, "Comite de salut public." Would you believe it? I was so ignorant a young fellow that I had no idea of the meaning of the words. However, I entered the citizen's room without fear, and sat down in his antechamber until I could be admitted to see him. Here I found very few indications of his reverence's profession. The walls were hung round with portraits of Robespierre, Marat, and the like. A great bust of Mirabeau, mutilated, with the word traitor underneath. Lists and Republican proclamations, tobacco pipes and firearms. At a deal table, stained with grease and wine, sat a gentleman, with a huge pigtail dangling down to that part of his person which immediately succeeds his back, and a red nightcap, containing a tricolor cockade as large as a pancake. He was smoking a short pipe, reading a little book, and sobbing as if his heart would break. Every now and then he would make brief remarks upon the personages, or the incidents of his book, by which I could judge that he was a man of the very keenest sensibilities. Ah, brigand! Malheureux! Charlotte! Charlotte! The work which this gentleman was perusing is called The Sorrows of Werter. It was all the rage in those days, and my friend was only following the fashion. I asked him if I could see Father Schneider. He turned towards me a hideous, pimpled face, which I dream of now at 40 years' distance. "Father who?" said he. "Oh, you imagine that Citizen Schneider has not thrown off the absurd mummery of priesthood? If you were a little older, you would go to prison for calling him Father Schneider. Many a man has died for less," and he pointed to a picture of a guillotine, which was hanging in the room. I was in amazement. "What is he? Is he not a teacher of Greek, an abbe, a monk, until monasteries were abolished, the learned editor of the Songs of Anacreon? Apostrophe, he was all this, replied my grim friend. He is now a member of the Committee of Public Safety, and would think no more of ordering your head off than of drinking this tumbler of beer. He swallowed, himself, the frothy liquid, and then proceeded to give me the history of the man to whom my uncle had sent me for instruction. Schneider was born in 1756, was a student at Würzburg, and afterwards entered a convent, where he remained 9 years. He here became distinguished for his learning and his talents as a preacher, and became chaplain to Duke Charles of Württemberg. The doctrines of the Illuminati began about this time to spread in Germany, and Schneider speedily joined the sect. He had been a professor of Greek at Cologne, and being compelled, on account of his irregularity, to give up his chair, he came to Strasbourg at the commencement of the French Revolution, and acted for some time a principal part as a revolutionary agent at Strasbourg. Even knows what would have happened to me had I continued long under his tuition, said the captain. Oh, the preservation of my morals entirely to my entering the army. A man, sir, who is a soldier, has very little time to be wicked, except in the case of a siege, and the sack of a town, when a little license can offend nobody. By the time that my friend had concluded Schneider's biography, we had grown tolerably intimate, and I imparted to him with that experience, so remarkable in youth, my whole history, my course of studies, my pleasant country life, the names and qualities of my dear relations, and my occupations in the vestry before religion was abolished by order of the Republic. In the course of my speech I recurred so often to the name of my cousin Mary, that the gentleman could not fail to perceive what a tender place he had in my heart. Then we reverted to the sorrows of Werther, and discussed the merits of that sublime performance. Although I had before felt some misgivings about my new acquaintance, my heart now quite yearned towards him. He talked about love and sentiment in a manner which made me recollect that I was in love myself, and you know that, when a man is in that condition, his taste is not very refined, any maudlin trash of prose or verse appearing sublime to him, provided it correspond, in some degree, with his own situation. Candid youth, cried my unknown, I love to hear thy innocent story and look on thy guileless face. There is, alas, so much of the contrary in this world, so much terror and crime and blood, that we who mingle with it are only too glad to forget it. Would that we could shake off our cares as men, and be boys, as thou art, again. Here my friend began to weep once more, and fondly shook my hand. I bless my stars that I had, at the very outset of my career, met with one who was so likely to aid me. What a slanderous world it! Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.